Hi, this is Joan Renner from Deranged LA Crimes in Los Angeles, California, and you're listening to Gangland Wire.
So when they take a silver dollar, they got to go around and look at banks and cash.
Former Kansas City Police Department intelligence detective and now attorney Gary Jenkins produced four documentary films, most recently Gangland Wire, creator of smartphone app entitled Kansas City Mob Tours. Download it now. If you like what you hear, go to ganglandwire.com. Navigate to the shop page. We need you to put a hit out on our donate button. Gangland Wire True Crime Stories is produced at the Big Dumb Fun Show Studio 4. And now, here's Gary Jenkins.
Well, good evening, all you wiretappers out there. I'm here with my good friend and co-host, Aaron, in the classic old Ice House building in Midtown Kansas City. Say hello to everybody, Aaron.
Hello, Aaron.
I said say hello to everybody. Now, you need
hello,
to change
everybody.
It up. Say hello, everybody, Aaron.
Hello, everybody, Aaron.
Anyhow, I always like to add a little levity, change things up.
Well, we found
if I can catch him off guard.
The listener that came to one of our live episodes that we recorded out at Stanford said, you didn't do the hello, Aaron,
yeah.
The say hello, Aaron. So it's just permanently embedded in every episode.
Right. That's one of our little cute little trademarks, Aaron.
I did not know. I did not know that.
Anyhow, you know, last week we had gone up to the penitentiary in Cameron, Missouri. It's the Western Missouri Correctional Center. We interviewed Keith Giammanco, who was known popularly in the popular culture in St. Louis as the Boonie Hat Bandit at one time. And he had a really unusual thing that happened to him. He got caught, which is not so unusual. That happens a lot. But after he got caught, he went ahead and he copped a plea in the federal system because bank robbery is a federal crime. Well, little did he know there was a kind of a, what I would consider a headline hungry prosecutor in St. Louis County who wanted to prosecute the Boonie Hat Bandit and get those headlines himself. So he took him under a little known, little used Missouri statute that allows the state to try somebody in the state system, even though he's already been convicted in the federal system. He tried him and got him convicted in the state system for bank robbery, and they gave him 20 years. Right now, he has done his federal time. If he had only been prosecuted like 99 times out of 100 or 999 out of 1,000, you do a federal crime, you get prosecuted in the federal system, you're not going to go back to the state system, be prosecuted for exactly the same crime. And that happened to him. It's a very unusual circumstance. And so he's up there now. But as you know by now, that he had an unusual thing happen to him while he was in the prison. He fell in love and got married. So we have on the line tonight with us is actually a new wife. I think you guys have been married about 2 weeks. Caroline Giammanco on the telephone. Welcome, Caroline.
It's nice talking with you, Gary.
Thanks for being here.
Yeah, we're really glad to have you. I think it'll be an
interesting. Thank you, Aaron.
Yeah, congratulations.
Hey, oh, yeah, congratulations.
We said that to Keith as well.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. It was a long road getting here, but we're really happy to be married.
All right. Well, great. And, you know, this is the second of two parts. So if you're a listener out there and you're tuning into this, I would suggest that you go back to the episode just before this and listen to it, and then come back and listen to this one. It will make a lot more sense what we're our questioning of our defendant tonight, shall we say, our questioning of our guest tonight will really be based on things that have happened and were talked about last week, just kind of an extension of that story. So it's really a two-part episode, need to be listened to in sequence. Caroline, you know, you are from South Missouri, correct?
Yeah, I grew up in the Missouri Ozarks in Douglas County.
So tell us a little bit about your childhood. People are interested in women who fall in love with somebody in the prison system and then get married, because you're not the first one, nor will you be the last to do it. So I think folks are interested in your story and interested in you personally.
They are. A lot of times people tend to think of women who are involved with inmates as kind of a crazy cat lady that we're looking for attention in unusual ways, but sometimes love just finds us where we happen to be at the moment. And when I met Keith, I was teaching at the prison at the South Central Correctional Center in Lakeen, Missouri. I hired him to be my inmate employee, and we'll talk about that more later, but I was an unlikely candidate for falling in love with an inmate because I grew up in a household where my dad was a deputy sheriff in my home county. I used to sit in when I was a kid. I'd sit in on trials going on at the courthouse. I knew all the local lawyers and the prosecutor by first name. I was in and out of the sheriff's office all the time. I knew all the deputies and all the city police officers. So it's not as though I grew up in a home where crime was considered normal. I was always on the other side of crime. And when I graduated high school, I went to the University of Arizona and got my degree in political science with an English minor. I've always been more on the law-abiding side, so it wasn't as though I was gravitating towards inmates or that my family was involved with crime.
Well, you were
That's why a lot of times at book signings, people are surprised when they see me, and I'm a middle-class professional teacher who seems to be not what they're thinking an inmate wife or girlfriend would be.
Yeah, they were probably looking for the homemade tattoos. They were probably looking for the homemade tattoos on your arms and the needle marks. And
they are.
I know.
And the missing teeth. And,
yes.
And looking for, you know, me to have poor grammar, and they're surprised that somebody who's college educated and professional will be involved with an inmate. But after talking to Keith, you also know that Keith isn't the stereotypical inmate.
That's for sure. I think Aaron has a question here. Aaron?
I was just saying, you know, you said as a growing up there, if you go to their website for the book, booniehatbandit.com, there's the page about the author, and the little town says here is Ava, Missouri, where you grew up, and you
yes.
said you were, you know, kind of in and out of the sheriff's and the police department's office. Not because you were in trouble, though, right?
No, because my dad worked there.
Yeah.
So it was just where I went after school. When I got off school as a kid, I went to meet my dad for him to drive us home, and that's where he was at.
You didn't have any of those pretty in pink moments with Charlie Sheen sitting next to you at the bench waiting for your dad to get off work, and he's there because he's maybe a rough and tumble guy?
No, but I went to school with plenty of them. My home county has a really bad reputation.
Yeah.
It's called Booger County.
And oh, my God.
People,
we don't need to dig into that, really.
Actually, well, funny, yeah. Nice play on words there.
Yes.
Paul Harvey actually talked about my home county a couple of different times. And in fact, back in the 70s, it would have been late 70s, he actually did a show where he said that if anyone wanted to get away with murder, they needed to go to Douglas County, Missouri, because there were six or eight murders in a year, and nothing was done about them. Then we got a new prosecuting attorney, and Paul Harvey actually about a year later went on and did a follow-up and said that things had changed somewhat in Douglas County.
Interesting.
But it definitely has a reputation. Anybody who finds out that you grew up in Douglas County here in southern Missouri will sometimes say, "Do you feel safe? Weren't you afraid living down there?" Well, to us, it was just home.
When I was young, I worked with some guys.
When anybody feels safe, you would think they would be the daughter of a sheriff or a police officer.
Yeah. Just,
you know, they're coming home to save you.
But, you know, when I was young, I worked at the Ford plant, and there was a lot of guys that came up from Douglas County and Greene County and Christian County down there, and they were a pretty hard-drinking, tough lot. I know that.
Exactly. And I have to admit that we kind of enjoyed that status, if that makes sense, as kids growing up. Not my family in particular, but just the high school kids there in Ava kind of liked knowing that we had the reputation of being the tough school. I remember when I was in high school, I went to the Culture Bowl at the college that's in Joplin, Missouri, and I was part of the German team, right? So So yeah. I was taking German as a foreign language. And so all the kids that were taking German and French at my school went to this college for a competition for the Culture Bowl. And we were walking along, and here we are, just some nerdy foreign language students, right? And there were some kids walking along by us, and they thought that they'd kind of bully us a little bit. And I turned around, and I looked at them, and I said, hey, don't mess with us. We're from Douglas County. They literally rocked back on their heels and apologized to us and walked away. And we thought that was so funny because none of us were threatening people. So it has had its benefits from time to time,
yeah,
from Booger County.
How did you then end up choosing to go to University of Arizona in Tucson? That seems like a kind of a world of difference from Douglas County.
It is. My oldest sister, she was 18 years older than I was, and she'd actually gone to college a month before I was born. And she had moved out to Tucson years ago to do graduate studies. She was still living there in Tucson, and just suddenly it went from me going to Mizzou, which is what I had planned on doing, to economics and her saying, hey, I'd really like to have her out here and everything. I ended up going to the University of Arizona. I remember my senior year, I had so many people who would look at me and say, oh, why are you going to Arizona? That's so far away. And I would just smile and say, because it's so far away.
Yeah, there's many a kid said that.
Right.
Exactly. I saw people who would go away to college, but then they'd come home and they would drive around the square Friday and Saturday night, just like they had in high school. And I thought, there's got to be more than that. I want to go someplace where it's actually college and it's not just high school 2.0 that I'm going to.
Right.
So then you graduate from the U of A and you you have a degree in political science and a minor in English?
Yes.
And you go to work as a teacher in a public school?
Well, what I did was I got married my sophomore year in college. After I graduated, I took a couple of years off. Had my two sons. They're less than 2 years apart in age. And I did it then because we figured we were already used to not having money. It didn't seem like a financial hit for me to be at home having the kids. And then I went back to college and got my 2 years worth of training that I needed to have my post-baccalaureate in secondary education. And then after that, I started teaching.
But that was also in Tucson?
And my first job was actually in the Four Corners area of New Mexico. It was a little town called Bloomfield.
Well, that's Indian country up there. But was it did the Indian kids go to school on the reservation, or did they go to the public school?
In Bloomfield, the kids went to public school. The population at Mesa Alta Junior High, where I taught, was one-third white, one-third Hispanic, and one-third Navajo.
Oh, really? Wow.
So
that would have been an interesting mix.
Yeah, and there were some, it was, and there were some definite racial boundaries in the school among the kids, and I can remember I had this one little girl in my freshman class named Shannon Manzanares. Something came up in class, and she looked at me and she goes, oh my gosh, she said, I even forgot that you were white. And I told her, I said, you know what? That's probably about the best compliment I can get.
Really?
Because the kids weren't looking at me as a white teacher or a this or a that. I was just their teacher.
That's great. You must have really related to them.
Yeah, I still keep in contact with some of the kids that I taught back in my first years of teaching. And I eventually, years later, ended up teaching 4 years on the Navajo Reservation itself at an alternative high school.
Now you were just that popular.
An interesting situation. So,
and then you were a teacher for 20 years in different, whether it was there up in the Four Corners or in Arizona and then in Missouri.
It's more than 20 years.
More.
Yeah, more than 20 years. Closer to 25 years now.
Well, so but you. You do this, and then you come back to Missouri at some point. You're teaching here in Missouri. I mean, there must have been a kind of like, well, I'm teaching in public schools, teaching on a reservation, or teaching in other public schools, and then
How did I end up in prison?
And in how did you end up in
what
prison?
What I'm really looking for is an opportunity to you know, teach people. You know, there must have been some motivation there for you, or just was it a job opportunity?
Oh, there was motivation, okay. It was called my bank account and the electric company and all the other bills that I had to pay. When I had moved back here in 2006, I was teaching at a little school not far from where I had grown up, and everything was great the first few years. But then the Great Recession hit, and property values plummeted, and schools make their money off of property valuations, off the property tax. And people were moving away from the district because they were trying to go to places that had more job opportunities. The school population was shrinking. It got down to 181 kids in the high school, and they had 4 full-time English teachers. They didn't need that many, and I was the last one hired, and I hadn't been there long enough to get tenure, so my position was eliminated to help the budget for the school district. I didn't have a job, and I eked by for over a year doing substitute teaching. That makes it really difficult. I had to cash in my state retirement that I had up to that point just to survive. At that point, you start saying, you know, personal comfort level as far as where you're working at isn't quite as important as making sure you still have a roof over your head or you can buy groceries. So I had put in an application during that time with the Missouri Department of Corrections for an academic teacher position, and I had given up on hearing anything because a year went by and I didn't hear a thing. And then one day in May of 2011, I got a letter asking if I would be interested in interviewing for a teaching position at the South Central Correctional Center in Licking. I said, absolutely. Now, I had worked, like I said, at alternative high schools before. So on the outset, a lot of people are like, oh my gosh, weren't you afraid every day of working in a prison? Well, yeah, anybody who says they're not afraid inside a prison, they're either crazy or they're lying. You should always have a certain amount of heightened sensitivity to what's going on around you. You've got to be situationally aware. You can't be complacent or content in some place like that. But I had taught a lot of kids who had problems with the law over the years, and that personality who's going to stab somebody or rob somebody or, you know, deal drugs at 16 isn't that much different than that person who got caught when they were 22 doing those exact same things. The bodies just may be bigger, but it's the same person that you're dealing with. And I had quite a few years of experience of dealing with that. And another thing that helped me get the position, I was told later after the interview, was that I had all that multicultural background, because a lot of people in Missouri just don't have a whole lot of exposure to other races or other cultures, because most of the prisons are put in small rural communities. And so the local populations aren't necessarily used to working with Black people or Hispanic people. And so they said it was a definite positive for me to have that experience working with multicultural students. So that's what helped me get the job.
You do the interview with them. They offer you a job. They must have to do kind of a background check. They do all that. They find that you have no background that would just stop you from having the job. And there you are showing up, I guess, much like maybe Gary and I did last week. Like at the, in was it Licking, you said?
Yeah, Licking.
Licking?
Yeah,
sorry.
I was teaching in Licking.
You were teaching in Licking, which leads to a whole lot of innuendos itself. but probably much like Gary and I,
we are not going there, Aaron.
We'll wait to hear what the inmates have to say.
Caroline, I can't control him. I'm sorry. I can't control him.
But you go probably much like we did to get into the prison to start this process, having, you know, been a teacher for many, many years. And how was that for you?
That's actually something that I talk about in my third book that I'm working on right now, which is called Inside the Death Fences. And I talk about how I was very contemplative on my drive there. For the first time I went there, besides the interview, was I had to do a pre-hire drug screening test. And it was a different sensation to have to go through metal detectors and have to be buzzed in and to hear these heavy metal doors slam behind you. It wasn't like a normal day at school. Right away, it definitely had a different feel. And prisons, as you can tell, and you were just in the visiting area there when you talked to Keith, they're very institutional feeling. There's nothing pleasant or warm about them. During that first experience, when I went in for my drug screening, I was told something by the officer who did the drug test that really sent my antennas up. So I know that there are probably people out there who think that, oh, the only reason why she's writing these books or why she's involved with criminal justice reform is because she got involved with that inmate and he twisted her head all around. No, I worked at the prison for a year before I ever even met Keith, and I saw a lot before I knew who Keith Giamanco was. But that very first day on my drug screening test, the officers were chit-chatting away. He goes, you know, a lot of people are going to tell you that you need to watch out for these inmates because they're all silver-tongued devils, and they're all going to try to manipulate you, and they'll say whatever they need to try to get you to do what they want. And he paused, and he goes, but you're going to have the same trouble with the employees, too. He said a lot of times the only way you can tell the difference between who you're dealing with, inmate or employee, is the color of their uniform. Because inmates wear gray and corrections officers wear blue. And he said, you seem like a really nice lady, and I just wanted to give you a heads up before you got in here. And I thanked him for it, and his words rang true through the course of the 2.5 years that I worked at the prison.
Well, the prison was a men's prison, right? Because I think, do they have a general male-female population prison in Missouri? I know my sister is a nurse.
No.
And she works in Wyoming at a women's prison.
No, the men and women are separated, and South Central Correctional Center is a maximum security men's prison.
Yeah, so it's definitely a man's world there.
Yeah, so, and I guess this is pretty topical right now with the hashtag Me Too, and so you probably have some stories of some aggressive predatory behavior by the guards, probably more so by the guards than predatory behavior as in the area of men and women relationships than you do prisoners.
You are exactly right, and the reason for that is because inmates are shackled literally as far as policy goes. There are certain rules that if they cross that line even a little bit, they're slapped, and they're slapped hard. They can have charges, additional charges put on them. They can be put in the hole for a year. Nobody enjoys that happening to them. So the inmates knew where they couldn't step over those boundaries. But the coworkers, they didn't. And for a lot of them, that's kind of like their feeding ground. And Paul Harvey also said one time, I'm going to paraphrase it, but it was something similar to this. He said, speaking specifically about Missouri's prisons, that if you want to see the worst that humanity has to offer, go to a prison parking lot at shift change.
Oh, boy.
Those are pretty powerful words.
That's pretty strong language for the prison guards. Man, that's amazing.
And then he says, good day.
And then he says, good day.
Good
yeah.
day.
The, yes,
so,
good day.
But so you're there for a
day
year.
Four.
So
yeah.
Yeah. The Anderson twins didn't have any ice cream. I remember those Paul Harvey stories. The so you're there for a year, and it is a full-time job, right?
Yeah.
And then you're... and
40 hours a week, and there were 9 or 10 teachers at the school.
And then did each teacher have their own assistant, or would they...
Yeah, actually, each classroom had two, and we would have 15 inmates per class, three-hour classes a day, and we also would have two inmate employees who acted as tutors in the classroom to help work with students and grade papers, things like that. When I was first hired, I was put in a classroom that already had two tutors, but then a couple of months before Keith, maybe a month and a half before Keith interviewed, one of my tutors had taken a different job at MBE, I believe it was, at the carpentry shop because he'd make more money. And I was like, well, I can't blame you for that. And so I had limped along with one tutor for a month, month and a half, and they had interviews. And on the day that Keith interviewed, there were actually four teachers who were interviewing for tutors. There were four of us that needed them. He was actually number one on mine and two other teachers' lists. And the only reason why he wasn't on the fourth one is because I was the third person that he had interviewed with that day. And when we were talking during the interview, we just instantly felt like we had known each other forever. And we were both kind of thinking, wow, this is crazy. But it was just as natural and smooth and easygoing to talk with him. It was like he was my long-lost best friend, and we were just so eager to talk and catch up. And we didn't even realize that an hour had gone by that we were talking during the interview when one of my coworkers came in and said, hey, are you about to wrap this up? And we were both like, well, that's kind of rude. You know, why? And she said, well, it's been an hour. We seriously thought it had only been about 15 minutes.
Yeah.
And that's the way it has always been whenever we've talked. One of the last things I said to him when we were wrapping up the interview was, I said, you know, I really want to hire you. I said, is there any way you could throw your next interview? And he laughed and he looked at me. He goes, no, that wouldn't be ethical. And I was like, you're right. You know, okay. So it wasn't until after all the interviews were done and we were all four of us teachers were talking about who we wanted. And the last teacher that he had gone to, she goes, oh, I don't want to hire him. He couldn't even do simple math on the math quiz I gave him.
He threw it. He threw it.
I thought, he threw the interview.
He did.
And you didn't tell him that, though, did you?
The reason, no. And
the first teacher's like, I told him to throw it, too. Second teacher, me, too.
No, they didn't. When it came time to be able to choose who we're going to hire, though, the acting supervisor said that, well, he was going to hire based on seniority, and I was the last hired, so I thought, well, who? There's no way I have a chance because two other teachers who've been here for a long time already want him. And one of them was a friend of mine, and she said, oh, are you kidding? If you want him as your tutor that bad, she said, I'll just let you have him, no problem. So that still left another person, though, who wanted him as their first choice. But as fate would have it, the one tutor that I had left in my classroom had been getting pressed by some of the younger guys, apparently. I didn't find this out till later. But he wanted out of the classroom. He did not want to be in that position anymore. And so he told the secretary at the school, I want out. Like, I want out yesterday. Get me out of that tutoring job. I don't want to be a tutor anymore at all. I suddenly didn't have any tutors at all. Voila. The next thing I know, Keith is in my room the next day.
Did you ever get a second tutor after
and
that?
That is how he was hired. Huh?
Did you ever get a second tutor in your room after that?
Well, we ended up we'd worked together for a couple of weeks. They went ahead and hurried up and did more interviews since I was missing a second tutor. And so about 2.5 weeks after I hired Keith, I interviewed other people, and I hired one guy, but he couldn't start yet. In the meanwhile, about 3 weeks after Keith started working for me, I tore my ACL at work, and it was completely gone. It wasn't even like, oh, it's just torn a little. There was none of it left. Right after the guy started working for me, I had to leave. So he'd only worked for me for like a week and a half or something like that by the time I went on medical leave for 6 weeks that summer. But I did have one, but it took a little while to get back in the swing of having two tutors that way.
But then after 6 weeks, you come back.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, but after 6 weeks, you come back, and Keith's still tutoring for somebody else in the in the meantime, and then
no.
picks right back up, or
no, they didn't farm them out, but they did let them come and, you know, work in my room and wax the floors and straighten things out, and there were a bunch of boxes that were left there from years and years and years of people just stuffing stuff in that particular room, and so they had gone through those and had other teachers come take what they wanted, things like that. So they were busy, they were working, but there weren't classes going on until I returned.
So you've written this book, Guilty Hearts, and in it you talk about the stigma that any family member of a prisoner experiences in, you know, at the prison and in the larger society, larger community, and they make it tough. I know, like, that prison there is way away from any of the large metropolitan areas where a lot of the people who go to prison come from. So how does a family even come and visit? And everything about the prison system seems like makes it hard for family members anyhow. And then they are not treated very well, it's my understanding, at the prison when they try to visit, and also back home when people know that they have a loved one, a relative who's in a penitentiary for some kind of a crime, they experience a certain amount of stigma. So, and now you're living it. So tell us a little bit about that. I think folks would be interested in that.
It's true that the guilt that an inmate has, or actually even backing up, as soon as somebody is arrested, the family starts getting treated differently. There's a lot of pressure on wives and girlfriends to distance themselves, to get out of that relationship. Brothers, sisters, family members, there's a push for people not to have anything to do with the inmate anymore, which has a lot of negative effects for a lot of people and society at large, and I'll talk about that in a minute. There is a stigma that people who love an inmate have, and I first noticed whenever I'd go around for book signings, I'd be in a Barnes & Noble for banknotes, I'd have the conversation with people who were shocked that I loved an inmate, and we'd sometimes, more often than people would realize, we'd be talking and somebody would get a little misty-eyed, and I'd lean over and I'd say, "Do you have someone inside?" And they go, "Yes," you know, in a hushed voice, looking around like it's something that was taboo to even talk about because they didn't want the social backlash. Women who are in the relationships will lose family members. People will disown them, just like they disown the inmate themselves. And my own brother disowned me. My sister has been pretty good about sticking with me through it. Her husband, not really so much at all. But my brother just flat out disowned me. Now, he lived in the St. Louis area, which is where Keith's crimes took place. And when he first found out that I had hired Keith, oh, he was fascinated. He wanted to know everything. Oh, do you have any inside details? What's he like? He thought that was amazing. And then when he found out that Keith and I were talking about me writing a book someday about him, oh, my brother thought that was wonderful because there might be a dollar to turn off of that. Where he wouldn't put up with my connection to Keith was when I actually loved him and valued him as a human being. That was where he drew the line, and he disowned me. He told me, "We don't associate with people who are in prison, nor do we associate with people who do."
Wow.
And it was over the phone, and I had a couple of times of saying, "Hey, Luke, you know, wait," and he just was like, "No," and he'd repeat, "We don't associate with people who are in prison, nor do we associate with people who do." And finally, I just paused and said, "Well, then I guess our association is over."
That's a tough one.
It was tough, and he didn't talk to me for 2.5 years. Peace was not made between us until he was on his deathbed. His wife did not let me know that he had cancer, did not let me know anything that was going on until he was put on life support and already had the vent in, so he couldn't talk. But when I found out, I drove up to St. Louis, And it was so bad, the hard feelings that she had towards me, all because I love Keith, who, I mean, my relationship wasn't doing anything to them. But I drove 4 hours up there only for her to tell me that I couldn't actually go talk to my brother, that I could stand at the edge of his room and look in as long as he couldn't hear my voice, so I couldn't talk to nurses in the hallway. He couldn't hear my voice, nor could I be in his line of sight so he saw me. And finally, after about a day and a half, one of his really good friends got her to relent, and they asked Luke, as I was standing in the doorway, if it would be okay if I came in, and he enthusiastically shook his head yes up and down. And so I went in and was able to make peace with him.
Wow.
And I told him, I said, I'm going to take about 30 seconds to address the elephant in the room. I said, I know you don't approve of my relationship with Keith, but I said, I want you to know that Keith really loves me and he treats me really well. And I said, in the end, isn't that really all that matters, is that we know that we've been loved and that we were treated well by people. And he looked at me and gave me this look and a nod like, well, you got me on that one. That's
yeah,
true.
Man, it's a pretty powerful story
and
there.
So,
well, at that point, had you already...
he still didn't let me go to...
Go ahead.
Pardon me?
Go ahead.
I was going to say, her feelings of animosity towards me were so bad that I was sitting there on the night that he died. I was there in the room because I didn't want her to be alone. And one of my brother's coworkers had stayed too. And so Rod and I were quietly having a conversation in the corner of the hospital room while she was at his bedside. And she turned around and started screaming at me and said, we hate you for what you've done. Your brother shouldn't hear your voice. And she wouldn't let me go to his funeral. They lived in Illinois, on the Illinois side up by St. Louis. I was not welcome at the funeral. And he was buried down in Douglas County at the little cemetery not too far from the farm we grew up on. And we were allowed to go there. But when my sister and her husband and I got there, she had made sure there weren't any seats for us. We had to stand. That's how vicious this hatred towards anyone who's connected to an inmate can be. And I am not the only one. I have met person after person after person who is just shredded by the people that should love them but aren't, simply because they're involved with an inmate. And it just really shouldn't be like that. I won't mention the town that I live in or that I teach in, but I will say that I have had parents, once word got out that I was involved with an inmate, because before we got married, I was still going by my legal name, right?
Yeah.
And writing under Giamonco. I had parents calling school board members demanding that I be fired because I was a bad influence on children just because I love someone who's incarcerated.
Boy, that's tough.
Loving Keith doesn't have anything to do with my ability to teach.
I was going to say it didn't affect your ability to teach. Right. The question I had before when you were saying there what had happened at the end with your brother was, at that point, you had already written banknotes, but had you been working on Guilty Hearts?
Yes, it was almost finished. Guilty Hearts was almost completely finished at that point.
Which seems to be very mirroring of the experiences that you were having right at that time.
Yes, it was.
And then the other question kind of comes to mind was your brother's wife. Did maybe she have a family member who had been incarcerated?
No. No. She's from the Philippines, and so she isn't connected to anybody over here. And as far as I know, nobody in her family had ever been incarcerated. But my brother always was a very rigid type of person, and it was always important to him that nobody make him look bad. And because of his own rigidness, he was his own worst enemy on that. So, but yeah, I'm not the only one that has gone through something like that. People have had their children disown them. They've had lifelong friends leave them behind. They have had siblings not have anything to do with them. Keith, from the day that he was arrested, one of his sisters didn't have anything to do with him. She's never even sent him a birthday or Christmas card. And his other sister, after he'd been in for 5 years, got in touch and wrote him off, just said, "I'm done." And that's tough.
Yeah,
and
that
the problem
be.
That people might say, well, you know, these people who break the law, they deserve to be miserable. Well, you can feel that way if that's what's in your heart. However, it's not really smart when it comes to public safety, because if you send somebody away to prison and then society manages to kill every single important relationship that that person in prison had, and so when they get out, they don't have any friends, they don't have any family left, their wife has left them, their kids don't know who they are and don't want anything to do with them, their siblings won't talk to them anymore, doors are slammed in their faces, what do they have to be good for? Nothing. And so if they don't have anybody to be good for, the accepting culture of prison, excuse me, the accepting culture of prison doesn't look that bad anymore, because at least in prison, nobody is persecuting you because you're a felon, because they're all felons. And in fact, it's an upside down system that we have, because even if you're not a tough guy in prison, you're not a name in prison, when you get out, if you go back to prison, you automatically get more respect in prison for being on your second or third or fourth bit in prison, which is just exactly the opposite of what society looks at. The more times you go to prison, the more of a piece of crap you are as far as they're concerned. But you get more credibility and more respect in prison if you've committed more crimes and come back. Well, in order to go back to prison, they commit crimes. And who are those crimes committed against? Whoever happens to be there. Could be you, could be me, could be your grandkid, could be the little old lady next door, whoever was convenient for them to commit crime to. Well, so
is that a lot of times because these...
A lot of that could be stopped. A lot of that could be stopped if those family relationships weren't eliminated. Because when I worked at the DOC, our trainings told us that the number one leading indicator on whether or not someone would reoffend upon release was having a strong, positive social network of family and friends when they got out, so that they weren't all alone. Because as it is, when felons get out of prison, people don't want to hire them. They don't want them living in their neighborhood. So it's hard to get jobs. It's hard to get a place to live. If you don't have some kind of support system, and you're living underneath a bridge, and it's February, that cell that you had that you really hated being in starts looking better.
Yeah, that's we're getting around to now to criminal justice reform. So let's talk about that. You know, Keith was telling us that in the current environment, at least in Missouri, I don't know about other states, we only know about Missouri here, that they've taken all the money away for jobs. He earned like $30 a month being a tutor, but being of service so people can come back out, help people come back out with some kind of skills that would help them get a little better job. I don't think they have, do they even have tutors anymore? I mean, school teachers, school classes anymore? And I guess it's, none of that helps, just like the not having a network on the outside, also not having any skills except, you know, what you learn from your fellow inmates, and that's how better to pick a lock or
pump
case
iron.
A joint or, you know, get stronger, bigger and stronger. So let's talk about that a little bit.
Okay. One of the things that I work on is reforming the 85% mandatory minimums for Class A felonies, which people say, oh my gosh, those are violent crimes. Well, a lot of legislators or a lot of people on the street might initially say, well, I'm willing to do something to help out the nonviolent drug criminal, but I don't want to do anything to help those violent criminals. They need to stay in prison forever. Well, there's a couple of problems with that. First of all, let's talk about the fact that nonviolent drug criminals, both nonviolent criminals and drug criminals, are, according to the Federal Crime Bureau statistics, the categories that are most likely to reoffend upon release. So it becomes a revolving door. Those people, great, you gave them a break, but they're going to go back and back and back. The violent criminals tend to not do that. They are way down on the list of repeat offenders. And just as a personal anecdote, in my classroom, I had time after time people who were in for drug charges in my GED classroom, because in Missouri you're required to get a GED, or work on it at least, if you don't have a high school diploma or a GED when you go to prison. And so these people were forced to be in my classroom. So I would have these drug felons who would say, I don't need no stinking GED to go out and make meth. I don't need a stinking GED to go sell drugs. And that's what I'm going to do when I get out of here. And like, they'd sit there and not do anything in class and be belligerent about it, because they didn't need a GED for what they were going to do. I never once had somebody say, I don't need a GED to go beat somebody up, so I'm not going to get a GED. I'm not going to get a GED because I don't need a GED to rob somebody. I never had a killer say, well, I don't need a GED to kill anybody, so I'm not going to work on my GED. All the violent guys, people who are in for violent crimes, whether they themselves were violent or not, as long as their crime was classified as violent, they worked hard on their studies. It was the people who figured, I'll get out and just do this again, that were those nonviolent drug criminals that people want to give the break to, who had the least amount of motivation to do anything to improve themselves. Now, let's talk about why 85% is even in existence in Missouri. Back in the 1990s, when Bill Clinton ran for president, in 1988, Michael Dukakis had been the front runner, almost certain to beat George Bush. But then the Willie Horton scandal came out, and when he had been governor of Massachusetts, he had allowed a furlough for this guy named Willie Horton, who went out and committed heinous crimes when he was on release. And so that came back to bite Michael Dukakis, and he lost the 1988 presidential election. Bill Clinton decided, that's not going to happen to me. I want to be president. So he came across as being tough on crime. And he implemented the Clinton Crime Bill, which was written by Joe Biden. And part of that said that federal funding incentives would be given to states who raised their mandatory minimums for Class A violent felonies to 85%, just like they were raising mandatory minimum for the feds. So Missouri had, prior to 1994, 40% for their mandatory minimum, which means if you had a 20-year sentence, that you would get 8 years that you had to serve before you were eligible for parole. When it went up to 85%, that became 17 years that the same person had to serve before they were eligible for parole. Well, that was working so well when Missouri took part in that, because millions and millions of dollars of federal monies were coming in, and those monies were earmarked for building more prisons. So Missouri went from having a couple of prisons to now having 22 facilities. Those were built on that Clinton Crime Bill money. In 2003-2004, the Missouri State Legislature thought, all this money coming in, this is great. We need to expand it so that more people fall under 85%. and we can get even more of these federal dollars coming in. So they took a crime like armed robbery, which by nature means you had to have a weapon. You had to have a gun that you used during the commission of that robbery. They made it first-degree robbery, which means that now all you have to do is have a witness say someone could have had a weapon. That's all it takes. And that's not hard for a police officer or a prosecutor to get somebody to go, well, yeah, I guess he could have had one, right? Got a Class A felony, 85%. Attempted murder, which is pretty clear-cut. There had to be the intention of killing someone, was expanded to be first-degree assault, which now says you only have to inflict serious bodily injury, which is very subjective. Is that a broken jaw, or is that somebody's in a coma because they got shot 9 times? There's no differentiation as far as statutes go in Missouri anymore. So suddenly, lots more people were being scooped up under the 85%. First-time offenders, it didn't matter. So that kid who gets into a fight at a Creek party wasn't expecting to get into a fight, and the only thing he has to defend himself with is the flashlight on his front seat of his Ford pickup truck. He picks it up and hits somebody in the face with it who's attacking him, breaks their eye socket. They can be charged with a Class A felony because they used a weapon. So, what has happened is we've had multitudes more people put in prison in Missouri under that statute, but the federal money has gone away. We don't have that money coming in anymore. And Missouri is paying, Missouri taxpayers are paying the entire brunt and cost of that. Even Bill and Hillary Clinton have come out and said that the Clinton crime bill was a mistake because it has devastated state budgets, it's devastated communities, and it was politically efficient at the time, but it's not been a wise move in the long haul. And so the problem, the biggest problem that we have in Missouri getting anything changed is, besides the knee-jerk reaction of, oh, we need to punish these people, is that because of term limits, which say that the longest anyone can serve is 12 years in the House, as far as these politicians know, something that happened 14 years ago was put in stone by Moses. They don't know that it can be changed. Nobody wants to rock the boat. And so something that happened back in the 1990s, we're still clinging to because nobody wants to be seen as soft on crime. But what we're working towards, and I have Republican sponsorship for the bill, is that they are given first-time offenders of first-degree assault and first-degree robbery are given an opportunity to be reviewed for parole at 50%. Now, if somebody's a troublemaker and they're still playing games and beating people up and getting into trouble in prison, they're not going to be given parole. But if somebody has shown a willingness to reform and rehabilitate, and they can be productive on the outside, why are we paying tens of thousands of dollars for each one of them every year when that space can also be used to get proven parole violators off the street? Because that's one of the problems we're having, I know, down here in southern Missouri, is sheriffs are complaining that we have, including my home town sheriff back in Douglas County where I grew up, he's been on air on record saying that we have no room in the prison system for parole violators to go. And so parole violators are let out into the community until, unfortunately, they hurt or kill somebody. And so it's an upside-down bottleneck where we have our prison system completely chock full of people who have decades to go before they can even be considered for parole, even if they could get out and be law-abiding citizens now.
Yeah, particularly,
and we have proven criminals who keep violating it, not not being able to be sent to prison.
Yeah, those mandatory minimums, they came under fire over the last few years, even in the federal system. And I know the judges don't really like those. They like to have a little more leeway. And at one time, there was some movement. Now, I don't know if anything's ever happened, but to take that out of the hands of the judges and some kind of, leavening some other opinions about people. Plus, you get people in there, and like Keith, they turn their life around, and they make it evident. Everybody knows in the prison system, everybody knows that he's totally turned his life around, and he's not going to reoffend, but he can't do anything because of the statute. So, and it's, we're just paying for Keith Giammanco to sit up there and
wait out his time.
Cameron is just waiting out his time. I know. I understand. It's crazy. It's crazy.
Especially crazy when, like you mentioned in the promo that or the intro, that he had already been convicted and sentenced in federal court.
Yeah, he's done his time.
All 12 of the crimes.
Yeah.
And he would have been home. I have his detainer release from the feds. He would have been home over 3 years ago. Missouri is paying for 100% of his incarceration. And that just, I would think that taxpayers would be upset by that. The feds took jurisdiction over this person, but yet he's never going to set foot in a federal institution.
Right. Well,
Missouri's paying for every bit of it just because of a headline-loving prosecutor in St. Louis.
Well, it takes a lot of political courage. More political courage than most people have to, as you use the words, to appear, even in the least manner, to appear soft on crime. So I'm not sure. I mean, I applaud your efforts and I support you. I understand it's a long, tough hill to climb.
It is. People have been brainwashed basically with these bumper sticker slogans of tough on crime, or if you can't do the crime, if you can't do the time, don't do the crime.
Yeah, they all watch Beretta.
Yeah, that's easy for Beretta to say.
Yeah, that's easy for Beretta.
Beretta's not paying for
all these
people to be incarcerated. And if there's anything, obviously public opinion is never going to go soft on crime. But what they are going to do is realize that they're tired of paying all these taxes. And that's the one thing, sad as it is,
exactly.
Prison reform isn't really about reforming prison. Prison reform is more about saving money. If we're not going to get that money from the feds,
it is, and we
got to do something.
We can be smart on crime instead of just tough on crime.
Now, do you have you got any crusading reporters out there? That's been my experience to affect this kind of a change. First thing you got to do is get the message out. We're going to help you get the message out, though, but we don't really have that many. We've got quite a few people in Missouri, but it's not. We don't have that broad a audience. But, like in one of these large city newspapers, have you made any inroads there with somebody in the Kansas City Star, the St. Louis Post-Dispatch to look at that, especially that deal you talked about, the Clintons and the draconian laws that were passed back then and the reasons for them and why it's not cost effective anymore?
Here's the interesting thing is that most media will not touch anything like this. And there's a reason for it. And we actually talk about it in banknotes. It's the same as why news reports about any crime committed only discuss how guilty the accused person is. They reemphasize, the crime, et cetera, et cetera. They never talk about, hey, but you know what? Joe might be innocent. He's innocent till proven guilty. He's been arrested. But hey, folks, hold off on your thoughts or commentary that he's convicted already. They never do that. And the reason why media doesn't like to touch anything that could be on the opposition of prosecutors is because most of their news tips, they get calls from police officers. They get inside information about cases from the prosecutor's office. That's where their news tips come from. they're not going to bite the hand that is feeding them all the juicy headlines. They don't want to rock those boats, unfortunately. So I have reached out to newspapers and television reporters and their producers, at the very least. Even if the reporters are interested, their producers won't let them run the story. I have done interviews with reporters who weren't allowed to then go ahead and air it.
I was going to suggest the Riverfront Times because they like a good crime story.
Yeah. You know the Riverfront Times?
Yes, they do.
They write a lot of crime stuff. Guy named Danny Wisniewski, I think. I'm not pronouncing that right. Yeah. But
go look at the article he wrote about Martin J. McNally, the airline hijacker, and then you'll have his name and probably an email address. You might contact him.
Okay, that'd be great.
Yeah, I met him once, well, Aaron, and I met him once, and he's a pretty good guy. So I would give him a shot. Tell him that we mentioned you, or mentioned his name, and thought he might be interested in your story. Well, I think we're going to wind this down now, Caroline. This has been a really interesting and enlightening interview here, and kind of complete the what we started with last week with your husband, Keith Giamanco. It's a great story. It's a human interest story. It's a politically topical story in many ways, more ways than I figured even when I started this. And I wish you luck. Let's mention, now you have a Facebook page for your book, don't you? What's the name of that Facebook page?
My Facebook page is Caroline Giamanco Author, and that's Giamanco. My website is boonyhatbandit.com. That's boonyhatbandit.com. You can definitely get in touch with me on either one of those.
Right. I messaged you back and forth on the on Facebook. That seems to work pretty well, folks. She answers. If you have any questions or want to get involved with this, prison reform and criminal justice reform, I would suggest you message her through that Facebook page. She'll get right back to you. Aaron, you got any other questions?
Yeah. Thank you very much.
I was just curious if Caroline maybe... if you, A, have any book signings where maybe people, you're going to be appearing public and will autograph your book or books that you have?
I had quite a few this summer and fall. I've got a little bit of a lull. I'm going to be at the Ozarks Writers League conference in Branson this Friday and Saturday. And then I've got a little bit of a break before January, and then I'm going to be in Norman, Oklahoma, and places like that. So if people will go to my Facebook page, they can keep up on what events I've got on the horizon.
And your book you're working on now, remind the listeners of that, and remind them the names of your three books.
Okay, my first book is Banknotes, The True Story of the Boonie Hat Bandit. My second book is called Guilty Hearts, The World of Prison Romances. And my third book that I'm working on is called Inside the Death Fences, Memoirs of a Whistleblower.
All right. And folks, you can get those on Amazon you can get them at your website, boonyhatbandit.com. Also, probably ask for an autographed copy there, couldn't you?
Yes.
Great, great.
And you talk to Keith by phone pretty often, I understand, having talked to him.
Yes, we do. We talk at least about 3 or 4 times a day. Not for long, because they only give them 15, 20 minutes at a time to talk, but we do get to touch base with each other. And it was really wonderful getting married on October 23rd because I blew the whistle on some things at the South Central Correctional Center. The Department of Corrections imposed a 5-year ban on us visiting. And before October 23rd of 2017, when we got married, the last time I had seen him was October 23rd of 2013. So it turned out that it was exactly 4 years to the date since we had last seen each other. And we have a little less than a year now to go on that ban.
Oh, I see. They, because you blew the whistle on some things, that was 4 years ago. Interesting. He said something about you couldn't see each other for 5 years, and I didn't quite put it together. Now I got you now. You've already done 4 years. I talk like you're in prison. Yeah. You've done 4 years of that time. You got one more year. So, well, I wish you luck. When you talk to Keith, tell him that we said hello, and we really like talking to him.
I sure will, and you're welcome to interview either one of us or both of us anytime.
All right, Caroline.
Absolutely. Well, if something comes up, if the legislation changes.
Yeah, I'll be watching your website. Your Facebook page anyhow. I get your feed, so I'll pay attention to that. Anything changes on that legislation area, we probably want to talk again.
Or maybe if she happens to be in Kansas City for a book signing.
Okay, that sounds great.
Yeah.
If you're in Kansas City for a book signing, definitely let us know.
You should have her come on. Have her come on the Big Dumb Fun Show.
Yeah, absolutely.
He has a show on Monday nights that's more of a drive time independent music radio. But if you're up in Kansas City, let us know.
Okay, that would be great. Yeah, I tend to get up there, every couple of months or so.
Okay, great, Caroline. It's been great talking to you.
I just had a. Oh, it's been great talking to you.
What'd you say? Go ahead.
Thank you so much for having me on.
You started to say something. Say that.
I was going to say that I had a book signing in Independence just a couple of weeks ago.
Oh, I didn't realize that. I remember you had another one out in Olathe a few months ago, and I missed that one. I was going to try to run out there, and I missed that one, I didn't realize you had that one. Well, that's
might have been like the fifth when we were going day up to Cameron.
Yeah, it was just before we went up to Cameron, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. It was the weekend before you guys went to Cameron. I was at the Independence Barnes & Noble.
Yeah. All right. Well, it's been great talking to you, Carolyn.
Yeah,
good
thank
night.
You.
Same here. Thank you very much.
And we had a great feed on that, the whole thing. We never had any kind of little whining in it or anything.
Yeah, like last night, the FBI agents, there was a couple instances where it just was kind of oddly
audio. Drop off a word or two, and then it just froze a couple of times. We had them repeat stuff, but this was perfect all the way through. Great.
Yeah.
Well, that's quite a story, isn't it, Aaron?
That is an amazing story. Well, both of them it is. I mean, certainly Keith for robbing 12 banks
is
an amazing story. And then Caroline for becoming a teacher and working in the prison system like she did. Interestingly enough to me, I thought it was a kind of an interesting crosshair in their timelines, because in that same period where Keith had a downturn because of the stock market and everything went bad, was the same, like 2006, was the same time that Caroline struggling and having come back to Missouri and losing her job and having to try to make ends meet as well. That there was kind of I thought it was kind of ironic.
Boy, that great recession we had after everybody lost their homes and the economy fell so flat for about a year there. That really affected a lot of people. And there's two people right there that it affected quite a little bit. But what's interesting is, and then it brought them together in the end. So go figure.
If it hadn't happened.
I know.
They would probably have never met.
Well, life is strange sometimes, isn't it? It's sometimes you.
Yeah, it's strange. She's hooked up with a guy who's in prison. I'm single and on the outside. I can't find anybody.
You can't find it. Poor Aaron. Poor Aaron. have any single girls out there that are listening here in Kansas City? Poor Aaron.
Yeah, right.
I think it's probably time for a public service announcement. Aaron, if you have a friend or a relative that has a problem with drugs or alcohol, make your first call to First Call. Call 816-361-5900 or go to their website, www.firstcallkc.org. What do you got to say to that, Aaron?
I got to say, folks, you need to get the documentary that started it all, Gangland Wire, available for purchase or rental on Amazon. And then after you're done watching that, you're going to want to get the Kansas City Mob Tour app. For $1.99, you can get on your iPhone and take a personalized tour of notorious mob locations in and around Kansas City. And while you're going on that tour, you can download episodes of Gangland Wire, over 150 free episodes from the mob of Kansas City to Las Vegas, to airline hijackers, to the cops who investigated Bob Berdella, and stories of the Union Station massacre from the mouth of the men that did it. It's Gangland Wire. And then you're going to get Gary's latest incarnation, his book, Leaving Vegas.
The true story of how FBI wiretaps ended mob domination of Las Vegas casinos.
Or the written words from the mouth of the men that did it in a book form that you can read, but then you're going to want to get the Kindle version that has hyperlinks to audio files in video transcriptions of those words from the mouth of the men that did it.
All right, say goodnight, Aaron.
Goodnight, Aaron. Bumper music provided by Audd-O-Matic. Follow them on Twitter at Audd-O-Matic Music.